Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, got a full house today.
We certainly do. First up on Atlanta Business Radio, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast hotel profitability expert with hotel effectiveness, Mr. Dell Ross. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Well, Dell, before we get too far into things, tell us a little bit about hotel effectiveness. How are you serving folks?
Hotel Effectiveness is an 11-year-old company that serves the hotel industry in North America. We address the largest line item for any hotel, the biggest expense, about half of their total cost, which is labor. And for every hotel in North America, this is the fastest growing line item as well. It's growing about five times faster than revenues, and now revenues are going down. So our software is used to eliminate all the waste that is inherent in most hotels' operating practices, and it enables smart scheduling that's tied to their demand. And we now serve over 4,000 hotels. We're growing incredibly rapidly, and we have 10,000 hotels in our line of sight.
Now, if they're not using your software, what are they doing?
Our biggest competition today is two things, Excel and ego.
Excel spreadsheets?
Excel spreadsheets, and I've been doing this for 25 years. I don't need anybody to tell me what to do.
So they're just, they don't have a software solution? They're just kind of winging it?
They're winging it. The most common scheduling approach for hotels is schedule like last week. Mm-hmm. And the challenge with that is last week, the needs for staff vary based on how many people are in the hotel and whether they're staying over or leaving or arriving.
Right. There could be an event. There's a lot of variables.
Exactly. And the challenge in our business, it's a service business. And if you end up understaffing for, say, housekeeping and rooms aren't ready when guests arrive, well, that's a problem. People get in trouble. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they staff for the peaks of last week, right? It's always staffed for the peaks, and it's actually staffed for the highest peaks, like those unusual things. A distressed passenger bus shows up and dumps 20 new guests into the hotel that were unexpected. You end up staffing for that level, and you may not need them. You won't need them. You end up overstaffing by about 20% on average. So what we do is we link the actual staffing model, the schedule, to the forecasted demand, what's actually going to happen in the hotel. And we do that for every position in the hotel, and that eliminates a ton of waste.
So then how do you handle that forecasting to make sure that that's accurate?
Hotels are actually really good about knowing next week's volume. That's highly predictable. We also have historical data to help them with that forecast if that's necessary. And most schedules are built about 1 or maybe 2 weeks out. This is actually changing around the country. There's some laws that are going into place requiring hotels to actually staff a little bit more aggressively and more further out so that employees know when they're going to work. But for the most part, it's about 1 week out, and forecasts are pretty good for that.
And then you mentioned these kind of unexpected things. How does your software take into account the unexpected?
Unexpected is fine. One of the things we do is we also help them monitor and manage overtime and use of contractors. When something like that happens, like an unexpected spike happens, you call in people. That's normal, and that's perfectly fine. And those people, the hours incurred there, are tied to the revenues that are generated. So that's absolutely fine. What's more pernicious is the overtime that is not connected to revenues. This happens when people maybe on a regular basis clock in 5 or 10 minutes early or shave a little time off of a break or clock out a couple minutes late. That adds up. On an individual pay period, it might only be a half an hour or 45 minutes, but if 10 people are doing that and they're doing that every single week, that actually can add up to a lot of money. So we eliminate all of that. We call it junk overtime. It's a big driver for cost in hotels.
And then so how is the, once somebody decides to implement the software, what does kind of that look like? How does it change what needs to be done at the hotel? How disruptive is it?
Well, for hotels that are actually putting some thought into their schedule and trying to align the schedule to the actual needs of the hotel, they're spending, every people manager in the hotel is spending about 5 hours a week building a schedule. And they're doing this through a painful manual process and usually a whiteboard, maybe a spreadsheet. Using our software, it takes about 5 minutes to build a perfect schedule, one that's absolutely aligned to your needs. In exchange for that, we ask for 5 minutes a day through our 5 minute daily labor check-in, where they go in and they see how are they doing against the plan? How are their labor costs versus where they should be according to the demand drivers and the labor standards that they have in place? And they make adjustments. They document things like those exceptions we were talking about. And they talk about what they will do differently next time. And all this rolls up. It gets captured at every level and for historical purposes so that the general manager and the regional manager and the owner of the hotel can all see what's going on every minute of the day. They know what's happening with their biggest line item.
Now, is it something where this is leveraging maybe artificial intelligence or machine learning to make them smarter and learn so they can be more efficient moving forward?
There's an awful lot of opportunity to use the data in ways like harnessing machine learning and artificial intelligence. Right now, it's a bit of baby steps. We're using the data that they have, and it's very straightforward. But what we're working on is today we give our hotels the standards, the staffing guidelines that are appropriate to their segment of hotel, and then they can adjust those based on their own business model. For example, the standard limited service hotel like a Hampton Inn, the turnover time, the time it takes to clean a room might be 22 minutes, right? So right. We'll create a standard that says for every anticipated checkout, you need 22 minutes of labor.
Right.
They can tune that. We are developing technologies that are like machine learning that will help tune that standard to that actual hotel, and not only incorporating best practices, but also incorporating that hotel's own ambitions and capabilities as proven over time.
Now, is there any kind of gamification where people can say, oh, this person's really good at turning a room and only takes them 18 minutes? Like, can you drill down to an individual to say who's a top performer?
You can. And actually, that's one of the things we found kind of interesting. The hotels that are using our software the best are, in fact, using this as a coaching and training tool. It's not necessarily that shorter amount of time is better. In fact, it could be that they're taking shortcuts. So you don't necessarily want to see somebody clean your room super fast because they might not be doing as thorough a job. What you want to see is you want to understand why is there a deviation from standard. We have a hotel that's been using our service now for several years, and they noticed that one of their best performing room attendants, housekeepers, was actually their productivity had slipped. They were taking 10 minutes longer to clean a room. They found this out through our software, and they approached this person to find out what was happening. Turned out her husband had been diagnosed with an illness and was in the hospital, and she was juggling not only her normal job and childcare needs, but also spending every night in the hospital. Well, that employer was able to actually give her some special leave, paid leave. They were able to adjust her work schedule, and this was all done in order to alleviate the stress that was being caused by this unique situation for this valued employee. We were really happy to know that our tool, which on its surface is a logistics tool, could actually be used to help people take care of their employees in a way they couldn't before.
Right, and probably in ways you didn't anticipate.
Right, exactly. We love that.
Now, tell us about how this product came about.
So this was the company was launched 11 years ago by two veterans of the industry, Mike Martin and Taylor Beecham. They left IHG, my former employer. We all worked together there. And at IHG, they ran our call centers, our global call centers. We had over 2,500 representatives around the world handling reservations, calls, and service calls from customers around the globe. Well, these guys built a model that used forecasting data to basically staff these reservation centers and keep the two big numbers in reservation centers are occupancy, the amount of time that people are spending actually talking to customers, and hold time. And usually those things move in opposite directions. If you have high occupancy, people have to wait a long time to get a rep.
Right.
Well, with this really good algorithm that they developed, we had incredibly high occupancy, above 85%, and hold time of less than 20 seconds, which is two rings, right? Incredibly fast. And they were able to do this and maintain a culture that was absolutely spectacular, overall annual attrition of less than 8%. They took that competency both in how to manage people and in intelligent scheduling and brought that to the overall industry back in 2008. And we've been growing ever since.
And then how do you forecast your growth? You said that you're in, 4,000 right now?
Yes, we're in over 4,000 hotels. We've more than doubled our number of hotels in the past year. We intend to keep up that growth rate. As hotels see a lot of pressure on their margins right now because of the continued growth in distribution costs, the drop in occupancy, they have to turn to their expense line items, and labor is half of their expenses.
Now, what percent does this help them? How much money does this save them by implementing the software?
A typical hotel should be able to lower their total labor costs by 5 to 15%, and that actually matters a lot for a typical 120-room hotel. Labor may represent $3 or $4 million of cost a year. So you can actually drop your cost by, say, $300,000 to $400,000. That's cash right in the owner's pocket, right in the management company's mm-hmm. pocket. In addition, it increases the asset value. So if you assume that a hotel is the value of the hotel is about 10 times the net cash flow, adding $300,000 right. of profit or cash flow is $3 million of value added to that asset.
Now, I'm sure now it's easier to tell that story, but how are you getting the word out to the hotels to make the shift from the inertia of not having this to having this?
So up until late last year, we grew by word of mouth, mostly referral, inbound calls. We actually have been more aggressive at going out to the market, to telling people that we exist, and that's actually made a big difference. So now we are working with more than half of the top 50 management companies in the world, which happen to be mostly in North America. We exhibit at trade shows. We've initiated some very targeted advertising and marketing programs, and we've grown our growth capacity. So I was brought on as the chief revenue officer responsible for growth at the end of 2018, and it's been good to be able to offer a product that actually works, that makes a big difference, and helps these entrepreneurial hotel owners achieve their ambitions.
Now, how quickly before they notice, like, oh, wow, this is a lot better?
They can actually notice an impact within the first couple of weeks of using this. First, we get a lot of arms crossed for whenever you change anything in a hotel. It's an ancient industry. You get a lot of resistance at first. But as soon as they get that, they go from 5 hours a week spent on building a schedule to 5 minutes, we get fans. And then when they never get yelled at for blowing their labor budget,
right.
we get even bigger fans. And then after about 6 weeks of usage, if that person ever leaves the hotel, they want us to come with them. That GM is going to bring us with them because they can't run a hotel without us once they get used to it.
Now, I would imagine Atlanta's a good market.
No, it's an excellent market.
And so you've expanded outside of Atlanta, obviously, if you have 4,000.
Sure. Hotels. We have hotels in all 50 states. Yeah, we have all 50 states. We actually have a deal pending in one of the territories. I'm not going to say which one because there are not many hotels there. And we also serve hotels in Canada.
Wow, good stuff. So now the pain that this hotel is having is just they're frustrated or it's taking a lot of time with their staffing?
Well, the pain is cost.
It's the money.
Right? It's cost. Right. They're seeing double-digit increases in labor costs because of the natural tendency to overstaff. Wage rates are going up like crazy. 22 states have implemented increased minimum wages. We have a lot of low-wage jobs. So
right.
A housekeeper that only 4 years ago would have made on average $9 an hour is making about $13 an hour in major markets today and more in some markets. That's a big deal. With scarcity of labor, which is the reason why wage rates are up, we're also seeing overtime spikes. Historical average around 2%.
Right.
It's actually about 8% for the industry. And contractor usage generally was in major markets before running at about 8% of total hours is now looking at 25-30% of total hours in some markets, and almost every market is seeing a dependency on contractors, and the contractor rates are very high.
So if somebody wanted to learn more about the firm and the software, what's the best way to website?
Hoteleffectiveness.com. It's a long URL, but it's worth the typing.
Good stuff. Well, Dale, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Oh, you're welcome.
Hey, Dale, stay with us. We're going to visit with a few more guests this morning, all right?
Absolutely.
All right, next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us Chief Privacy Officer with Relix. Please join me in welcoming to the show Mr. Mike Lamb. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you. I'm sorry you have to follow that act. He did a very good job and articulated what they do and how they do it pretty well, didn't he?
He did a great job.
But you're kind of an expert on machine learning and AI. You can share some stuff about that, huh?
We do a lot of machine learning and AI and data. So it's privacy and the intersection with AI is a subject of great interest for our company and for our regulators.
So tell us about RELX.
RELX is a global company based in London, but we operate through our divisions. One of the main divisions is the business LexisNexis Risk Solutions, based right here in Georgia, that uses data to do identity authentication, credit rates, fraud prevention, and the like. Then we have other businesses such as Elsevier Academic Publishing. We have an exhibitions business. We own Comic-Con New York. So we're a diverse company.
That's very interesting. So now
you heard it here.
So if you want Comic-Con New York tickets, you know who to call.
Wow.
So now you are the chief privacy officer.
Yes.
Now, what is that title? What are you doing every day?
Well, as a company, and particularly a company with some divisions that use a lot of personal data to create services, we are very focused on being a trusted custodian of the data we hold. So I work on our policies to be sure we're using it in a compliant way, but more than that, we have to use it appropriately and implementing those policies, the actual accountability and being sure that we're using data the way we commit to use it. And then in recent years, as governments around the world are looking at regulating privacy, I'm talking to a lot of legislators about what we think are some good ways to approach regulation of data and some mistakes to avoid.
So now when you're talking about privacy, everybody, I think, looks at it differently, right? The consumer, tell me, what does the consumer, a typical consumer, do they care about privacy? They say they care, but their behavior doesn't always isn't congruent with that.
Yeah. Everyone makes their own choice about privacy, and a lot of consumers do care dramatically about privacy, particularly in their use of social media, Facebook, Google, and the like. Doesn't mean they will say no if given a choice about do you care if your data is used, but they often want to have that choice.
They say they want to have their choice, but their behavior doesn't always match that.
Right, and indeed, we find that sometimes the politicians try to put more stringent controls than the consumers really even want on the use of data, because the benefits, say, online of customization and cookies and all these things, those can really benefit consumers, where you get, you know, you can fine-tune what the website looks like. Well, that only happens if you let them use cookies as the technology in the website, for example.
Right, but it also, when you are allowing the cookies and you're having all of this data kind of funnel to you, the stuff you want, does that kind of put people in kind of silos where they're only getting information of things that are like-minded and they're not getting really a diversity of information?
That's a risk, and that's a risk to be avoided. And so some consumers will have to make sure, and you control your own destiny about what websites you visit, and whether or not you want to customize it to just get conservative or liberal views or whatever it may be in politics. But this is clearly the age of digital data. This is really, really important to businesses and to consumers. And the U.S. today, with one state as an exception that I'm sure you'll get to, doesn't really have rules of the road on digital data. And we think it's time that they have that.
And then right now, in order to implement that, it has to happen at the federal level. Like right now, one state, probably California, if I was to guess the state, has more European standards of privacy and data.
California just implemented January 1 the CCPA. It's a state-specific privacy law. But particularly online data doesn't stop at a state border.
Right.
And online businesses don't stop at the state border. And so it's problematic from our perspective to not have at least a nationwide privacy law, nationwide single set of rules that work across the country. And so we're highly supportive of Congress enacting that. And indeed, privacy is a bipartisan issue. They may not agree on all the details, but no one's anti-privacy. And we're actually seeing the Democrats and Republicans working together on some privacy bills even as we speak.
Now, is there some common ground that we can just have a basic privacy federal law?
I think there is a lot of common ground. It's clear that businesses should tell people how they use data. It's clear and generally accepted that we should give consumers access to the data that we hold about them. And then when you get to control issues, giving the consumer the right to tell you to delete data or to not do certain things. As a general rule, that can be quite good, particularly in a social media setting. But we have to be careful that we don't disable the ability of government and businesses to fight the bad guys out there, to fight fraud, to fight identity theft. And some rules, including some elements of this new California law, go a little bit too far and actually hurt the ability to stop identity theft.
Now, we're talking a lot about data. There's so much data out there that's just being given freely back and forth with companies, individuals. How does a company kind of manage the data right now? I mean, is it possible to manage all this inflow of information by yourself anymore, or is this something you have to have kind of third-party experts helping you with?
If you're small, you probably need more third-party experts, whether it's legal experts or data governance experts. There's also some great privacy technology companies out there, one of which is OneTrust, based right here in Atlanta, which has grown to be one of the leaders in that area, and we use some of their services, for example.
And then, so like if you were a small to mid-sized business, what are some of the kind of low-hanging fruit that you can do to help deal with the privacy issues?
You want to organize the data you hold so that you know what data you're collecting and you know how you're using it. If a law like the California law applies to you, you're going to have to know that because you're going to have to disclose it. And if somebody asks for a copy of their data, you're going to have to give it to them, California resident. Same's true in Europe where they have what they call the GDPR, fairly robust set of privacy rules there. So understanding and carefully organizing the data that you hold is critical first step.
Now, where do you see artificial intelligence coming into play?
Artificial intelligence comes into play in a couple of different ways. Our LexisNexis Risk Solutions business uses AI with data to help prevent identity theft, for example. And to do it, because the bad guys have data and they have really good technology. And the only way to really compete against that and to resist it is to use technology and data itself to help the banks, to help the major online retailers and the like stop identity theft. Another area of great discussion among legislators with AI is if you're using AI with personal data to make important decisions about individuals, is that a problem? Is that a black box decision? And it shouldn't be. AI can be very productive and highly accurate, but you need to still understand the logic of what's being done if it's creating important decisions about individuals.
Now, when you're dealing with fintech companies and the customer's expectation is like instant everything, right?
Right.
And then you got to vet, is this real? Is the person who they say they are? Is the place that wants the money, are they who they say they are? That's just like it seems like an impossible problem to solve.
It's challenging, but that's the beauty of a company like, again, the example of LexisNexis Risk Solutions. If somebody's ordering something online and they want it delivered to an address that's not their credit card address, we in the background, if they're using us, will say, oh, is this other address associated with them or with a relative? Invisible to the consumer, but if it's not associated with them, they still want to make the sale. They'll put it through some more escalated review. But if it is, oh, that's their second house or that's a close relative's house, then the sale goes through because there's very low risk of fraud.
But that's happening in milliseconds.
Exactly.
Right. So, I mean, the ability to process that much data that quickly, I mean, it's amazing.
We have in Alpharetta and Alto backup locations in Ohio and in Florida, some extremely large supercomputers that process this data and in truly milliseconds. I'm sure Google might have more computers, but we're probably in the same discussion.
Now, tell us about the future. What can we expect? Like when 5G, is 5G going to impact any of this?
5G doesn't change the policy issues and the need to give people guidance on digital data. Consumers need basic rights. Businesses need to know the rules of the road. It just means there's more data flowing quicker.
And then so that'll help you do your job better, or is it going to help the bad guys do their jobs better?
It won't really interfere with us because we're not delivering much to our business customers or government customers over cellular wireless, but they're interacting with their consumers that way. It just means that you have more mobility and less of a fixed location, and that's a slightly greater fraud risk. But you need tools that it can identify fraud risk, you know, and the fraud risk using AI, we look at is the device that's making an application, making a purchase, has it been associated with past fraud? Is the internet IP address? Is the email address? There's history. And only if you can quickly analyze all of that and say, risk of fraud or not, can you really help defend the consumers who are really the victims if there's identity theft.
Now, what are the things that keep you up at night?
I do worry about, as legislators try to protect privacy, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
They might help too much.
They might they might do some things in the name of protecting privacy that really hurts consumers. For example, in new California law, they have a right to opt out of sales of data to third parties. That sounds good. Well, all of our identity theft prevention services are considered sales to third parties.
You're the ones watching the watchmen. Yeah.
And they let the bad guys opt out. Right. And that should not be the case. When we actually advocated, you know, have a fraud exception or prevention of crime exception, and they go, oh, we're not going to do that. Another problem in California is they said, don't discriminate against somebody for exercising their privacy rights. Sounds good. But that constrains the ability of retailers to offer discounts to people who are in their shopping programs, their frequent shopper programs, like at the grocery store, because that's use of data. And if you want to give discounts, well.
So you're discriminating against, you're helping your best clients.
Exactly. But you're discriminating against those who don't give you data. And so there's some unintended consequences, right. And legislators need to be careful. And that's what keeps me up at night, that they'll do some things that aren't really needed. One other example, Europe, they regulate data that's in the newspaper. That's their approach. It's not private. It's public. It could be in the London Times. We don't need to regulate what's in mass media or government published records here. And there are some who advocate that we should just copy Europe. And we don't think that's necessarily good for a solution in the United States.
Now, what are you the most optimistic about?
I am optimistic that there will be a bipartisan nationwide privacy law. Hopefully this year, if not, maybe next year after the election. I know Congress is very busy. But what we don't want is we have a California law now.
Can't have 50 laws.
Well, we have 5 or 10 states looking seriously at new laws right now. And even one or two laws is too many. Businesses spent $55 billion complying with the California law. And that estimate comes from the California Attorney General. That's $5,000 for every family of 4 in California just to comply. We don't want that repeated 10 times, 20 times. It's not a good use of capital. It doesn't really protect consumers.
So now, how does Relics go to market? How do you get your customers?
We're largely a B2B business. So LexisNexis Risk Solutions goes to market. We serve either government, we help with law enforcement, or we serve corporate anti-fraud or corporate transactional businesses. Elsevier is academic publishing. You know, we're serving the academic community, publishing scientific journals and the like. So we're a B2B business, but we're using data about individuals and some of those services. So the consumer privacy laws are still very important to us.
And if somebody wanted to learn more?
Go to relx.com and you'll read about all of our divisions, or go to lexisnexisrisk.com if you want to hear more about the division that's based right here in Georgia.
And then there's a lot of white papers and things like that about privacy and data.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of discussion. What you don't want is a privacy law that results in a lot of lawyers suing and getting multi-million-dollar paydays for lawyers and things that don't really help consumers. So there's a lot of back and forth as these laws get fine-tuned right now.
And especially you're dealing with experts that are trying to help lay politicians make kind of big rules that are affecting everybody. That sounds like trouble.
Yeah. And you get a lot of politics involved too. Again, the trial lawyers want to be able to sue everybody. People who use data, Silicon Valley wants complete freedom to use data.
Right.
And that's, you know, the solution somewhere in the middle.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much. It's important work you're doing.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate the insight on the unintended consequences. I think we probably suffer that type of thing in a lot of different domains, and perhaps in this one more than any other. So keep up the good work and the good fight, man.
Thank you.
Hey, stay with us. We're going to visit with one more guest, okay? All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio. Lee, you ready for the headliner, buddy?
I am.
He's been waiting there patiently. He's been taking copious notes. I saw him nod his head a lot, particularly in that last interview. So he may have some insight perspective on some of those topics as well. But we have with us the Grand Poobah, the Chief Executive Officer with Brightwell. Please join me in welcoming to the show, Mr. Mike Gaburo. How are you, man?
Good, Stone. Thanks. And thanks, Lee, for having me.
Well, tell us about Brightwell. How are you serving folks?
So probably the easiest way to think about Brightwell and what we do would be to put yourself in the shoes of, you know, let's just say you're a 28-year-old man and you live in Jakarta, Indonesia. You're one of maybe 10 kids and you're hardworking, you're well-educated, but it's hard to find work to support your family and the family that maybe you're planning on having there in Indonesia. And so you make a decision to go abroad. You make a decision to go to work in a hotel, maybe one that Dell supports, or in a healthcare facility, or on a cruise ship. And you sign up basically for open-ended travel away from home, 6, 9, 12 months at a time, in return for, relatively speaking, great money. So you've made a kind of a bargain to really increase your standard of living, but you've made a big sacrifice in terms of being away from loved ones, being a stranger in a new country. What Brightwell does, because there are about 165 million people that fit that exact bill, according to the UN, Brightwell is the banking tool that that person, that Indonesian man, and 300,000 other people use to really control their financial lives and to kind of make good on that big bet that they're taking by being able to control and send money home and spend and really live their life in a way that they want to in a place that's not their home country.
So now, for Brightwell, are you the solution for the cruise ship? Or are you the solution for the individual?
So really everything we do starts and ends with the consumer. The consumer has to pick us. But we also have relationships with the cruise line or the hotel company or the business, because there's a whole simplification of their global payroll that we facilitate. But really, we spend a lot more time and energy thinking about how to be useful to that end user to get them to want to pick Brightwell to be their really their digital bank.
So now, if they're not choosing Brightwell, who are they choosing? Are they just using PayPal? Like, how are they getting money?
So let's just say, let's take that Indonesian that I talked about to open the show, and let's say he's working on Princess Cruise Lines,
right?
And he is a steward. He gets paid every month and has lots of choices about how to get that money back home to Jakarta. He can go to the ATM in cash and put it in his pocket and save it in his cabin until he goes home.
What percent are doing that?
I would say maybe a third are doing that, based on either habit or, lack of trust of anything digital.
Right, they feel in control of that. They hold the money in their hand.
It's, when you've got a pocket full of cash, what could go wrong?
Exactly.
But to answer your question, there's that. There's the cash user. And there are any number of digital tools out there, places like Remitly or TransferWise or WorldRemit or even Western Union or MoneyGram that would allow that our Indonesian user to get his money back home.
And so that's is Brightwell for that person that wants to send it back home, not the person that just wants to travel the world? And
so if we have, let's just say right now we've got 300,000 Brightwell account holders, the vast majority of those people really do live to support their life back home. There's a subset of people that do, as you said, Lee, take a job to go and be away and to see the world. But the predominant use case for Brightwell for our users is either to save money, and or to send it home.
And then, so obviously this is in the fintech industry. How did it get started?
So the company is about 10 years old and really has its roots in a prepaid card business that was spun out of a bank by some Atlanta-based investors about 10 years ago, and really has morphed over the years to create a unified tool that has digital banking, the ability to store value, the ability to move money in lots of different ways to over 120 places, and the ability to do Venmo-like peer-to-peer transactions all within the Brightwell app.
And then so Brightwell consumers can share funds through internally through a Venmo like experience.
Exactly, because it's a it's people know each other. So and Del, maybe you see this in the hotels. You have a lot of friends, family that will come to work at the same place. Or back to our Indonesian crew member on Princess. He has lots of friends, family members, perhaps working with him on Princess or perhaps on other ships. And so we make it, like Venmo, free and seamless to move money within the network.
And then, so then they can just share amongst themselves. That's a perfect solution for a lot of people, I would imagine.
I mean, in the same way that, that peer-to-peer is taking off in the U.S., it's, no less popular among non-Americans.
So now how do you kind of, make sure that there's no fraud in that?
Well, I nodded a lot while Mike was talking because it's a constant battle. If you think about, we kind of deliver two big things to our users. One is just simplicity and ease and choice, the goodness that you get when you open an app that you like. The other big thing is in the background, and that is implicit, right? Tell me that I'm not going to get hacked if I use your app, and tell me that everything you're doing on my behalf is compliant anywhere that I might want to do business. And so for us, we sort of, you know, the front of the house thinks a lot about usability and convenience. We spend a tremendous amount of time thinking about fraud prevention and then compliance with all of the money regulations around the world.
Now, when you're dealing with this kind of target market, I would imagine that these are, they're not the most educated people. Right, especially for financially savvy people that understand kind of the ramifications, and that's a challenge unto itself when you're asking them to trust a new technology.
Well, it is interesting because, you know, within our cohort of users, several hundred thousand users, it truly does span the gamut of people that are absolute experts in the digital world and in remitting money and will, you know, wait to time the dollar to rupee exchange rate until just the right time, and then they'll send $20,000 to India, all the way down to someone that has, you know, never had a mobile phone or never used a computer or, you know, certainly never used a digital tool. And that's the fun of it for us and for our people, you know, trying to design and implement something that's relevant to a really broad range of people.
Now, when you're dealing with maybe the unbanked or the less educated people, do they have to have a smartphone? Like, what do they have to have in order to use Brightwell?
So they have to have access to the internet and access to some kind of computing device. Just, it's no surprise to any of your listeners, you know, the mobile technology has really leaped ahead in you know, sort of the non-Western countries, and you've got high levels of mobile adoption in Asia and Africa and places like that. So just we sort of go along with that trend. Most of our users engage with us mobily, but we still have a big cohort that, you know, will use their own laptop or tablet or, you know, maybe one in a digital cafe somewhere.
Now, you talked about customers like that person from Jakarta. Like, talk about kind of your institutional customers.
So we'll stick with this this mythical but real Princess Cruise Line user. So we also have a strong value prop and need to be compelling to Princess Cruise Lines, who, you know, 10 years ago was paying their crew in cash. So Princess Cruise Line.
Is that true? 10 years ago?
Well, we are in the process of converting a large cruise line right now, literally this week, who today pay about 17,000 crew every month in cash.
Wow. So they have just piles of cash in the boat?
It's,
that sounds like a good heist movie.
Again, look, it's what, you know, what could go wrong? And so it's such an easy sale. Even I could make it to a CFO of a cruise line. You've got fraud, you've got cost, you've got theft, you've got employee unhappiness. So convincing that CFO to get rid of cash is pretty easy. You know, it's, Del said something, it's a little bit, really you're overcoming inertia, or that's the way we've always done it. That's the biggest challenge.
Right.
But in 2020, just about everyone agrees you don't want to be paying in cash, but we deliver a lot of value to that CFO, but I keep coming back to the user because that's where the action and the excitement and the value for Brightwell is. It's such an easy box to check for the CFO. The fun part is creating something compelling and engaging for the user.
So when you are focusing on the user, you're hoping that the user is going to demand this from whoever they work for?
Exactly.
And so it'll kind of drive it from the bottom up?
as we look ahead to kind of the next, you know, I'll call it Brightwell 3.0, it's really about taking the platform and making it truly that bottom-up consumer-led platform. Because, you know, right now, in order to use Brightwell, your employer has to agree that, yes, we'll engage with Brightwell. But there's no necessary reason for that. And so our vision for the next 5 years is taking this platform and being able to deliver it to all 160 million people out there that need it.
And then from that, then it'll kind of force the hand of all these institutions as they say they have to do this because their workers want it or their customers want it.
I think that, you know, again, back to what Dell was saying, there's a general recognition that labor is scarce and quality labor is even scarcer. And so we've seen our corporate customers start to look at our tool as something that is builds employee welfare and engagement. And so I think that if we walk into the treasurer, let's just say of Marriott and say, well, you've got 25,000 of your users who have opted into this, you know, why not make it something that is part of your global payroll process? So I think if we're able to solve and be compelling and engaging for that end user, that Jakarta crew member, we'll be okay with their CFO.
Now, when you are focusing on that, this kind of mythical Jakarta, crew member, how much of it from a corporate culture standpoint is this kind of educating the masses about services like Brightwell and just to help the unbanked people in general just kind of have more opportunity and open more resources up to them?
Well, you know, we all think our children are the most beautiful and our companies are the most brilliant. And we do have about, you know, 85 brilliant and caring people at Brightwell, but we're kind of standing on second base in the sense that anyone who works away from home and thinks about their family back home knows about, thinks about, is very wrapped up in the process of getting their money home. And so we do have a built-in advantage in that when we engage with that crew member from Jakarta, you better believe he is very, very conscious of, okay, how am I going to get my money home? We don't have to sell him on, you know what would be really cool? If you could actually get money home.
So you don't have to explain it to him, but there's lots of people out there that have these trust issues that you have to kind of educate and explain to them how this can work and the benefits of it working.
We get a ton of a benefit from the, you know, I'll call it the cohort or the tribal or the peer-to-peer nature of our user base. People know each other. They're related to each other. There's lots of case studies that we've created about, you know, people who sort of look like you, who've trusted Brightwell. You know, I'm not dismissing your point at all. It's a big deal for us, but everyone knows everyone else. You know, there's probably 3 degrees of separation, not 6. And we take a lot of advantage of that, and it really helps us.
Now, talk about the kind of the fintech community here in Atlanta. Are you still based here in Lee? You originated here in Atlanta?
We are here, not in Alpharetta. Like to be. No, we're down in the Vinings area, and we love it here. You know, we were a best place to work in Atlanta last year, and we're hopeful to get it again this year. And I think the reason that we've been successful and been able to get the right people to come and to stay is it's so immediately obvious the value of what we're doing, you know, that larger why. Because everyone has traveled, everyone has been the foreigner, you know, even if it's just as a tourist. And we can all relate to wanting to do things and do right by our families. And we can all relate to how frustrating it can be to be a stranger in a place. And so it really unifies our team, and it's super easy to, you know, convince people to work a little bit harder to hit a sprint deadline or to get a marketing campaign launched because it's so relatable what we're helping our users with.
And then how have you seen the Atlanta fintech community evolve over the years?
Well, I mean, I think I read somewhere last week that there are 38,000 Atlanta-based workers that are part of the fintech ecosystem. And, you know, whether that's the exact number or not, I don't know. But there's a lot of talent. And frankly, a lot of the consolidation that you've seen over the past year or so, it helps companies like Brightwell because we find a lot of people out there that really understand the nature of the work we're trying to do. You know, I will say that as much as we love it here and plan to build our future here, you know, there's some work to do around things like transportation infrastructure, access to housing. I mean, it's a great, great place. I love it here, but, you know, we've got work to do.
Now, are you finding maybe young people from around the country coming here specifically for fintech?
You know, I can't. Yes. I don't know. I can't ever say why people do what they do. But every month we'll do we do an all hands meeting. Our COO runs it. He does a great job. And he'll introduce all the new people we've hired. And where are you coming from? Why'd you come here? And a lot of them are coming from places like California, where it's
because of privacy laws,
too restrictive. So I think Atlanta has a ton of appeal. And it is a natural place for someone that's worked in financial services to come and make their home. But, luckily its appeal is a lot broader than that.
And then, for your growth, what are you looking most forward to in 2020?
So we are really in the midst of a metamorphosis of the company to take it to a direct-to-consumer solution. And so that'll involve investments in marketing, investments in regulatory assets like U.S. licenses. And so I'm just super excited to, you know, kind of build that next stage of Brightwell that will let us kind of rip the top off the platform and make it available to everybody that needs it.
And then so this is a global goal.
Well, we're a global business. You know, we're working with over 140 different countries. We work with very, very few Americans. So we get up every morning thinking about the world outside the U.S. We're all kind of geeked up and worried today about the volcano in the Philippines. We've got a big tier one support center, big for us, in Manila. And we're like really worried about the impact of that volcano. So it is a global mindset at Brightwell because that's where our users are.
Good stuff. Well, if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the website?
That's brightwell.com.
All right, Mike. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thanks.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.